another vector around which we can think of potential is potential for what? You know, given this is the person, who he or she is, their wiring, their skills, their superpowers, you know, what is the canvas on which they could go and paint? Somewhere I feel that discussion is often not had.
Who did you write this book for? Who's the target audience?
So when I started this podcast, and just like businesses think about where to play, how to win, in the context of the business strategy, I felt we all are grappling with where to go and how to grow in the context of our respective journeys.
What are some of the most common transitions that all of us go through?
One of the terms that Bruce Feiler uses, which I like, is called shape-shifting. Right? We often talk about the word resilience. And resilience, the metaphor people have when they use the word resilience is a shock absorber. You know, if I'm given a shock, do I have the resilience to absorb? He says that very often, that's not quite the case. Very often, to come out of a shock, you need to have a shape-shifting capability.
How does one navigate where you want to do it, but there's something holding you back?
Let me take my example, right? The background I come from, entrepreneurship was far away. My father worked in a public sector bank, and the narrative in my home was, don't ever go to the private sector because you never know, you might lose your job tomorrow.
I think we need to have a reframing, which is in the 21st century, there's no such thing as a stable job and a career.
Limited point I'm making is sometimes the leap cannot be avoided because only beyond the leap, you know, there is opportunity. And the paradox is till you let go of the trapeze, the next one doesn't emerge. When we look at self-awareness, very often people default to strengths and development areas. But I feel there are other dimensions of getting to know ourselves. When do we come alive? What feels like play? You know, what are the circumstances where we lose ourselves? What are our superpowers? You know, what does the highlights reel of our life look like? You know, when were we at our best? They said Google helps people search the world, but how do we search inside ourselves? But what I see people do effectively is really being aware of what your resources are, your networks, what gives you joy, what gives you energy, what is the kind of impact you want to have.
Your reflections on this idea of regret. And
the insight comes from Dan Pink, who's written a wonderful book called The Power of Regret. I love the phrase he uses. He says they are often like the photographic negative.
What you feel is the purpose of human life.
Okay. Wow. Better order in dinner.
Good evening and welcome to the Bangalore International Centre. BIC, for those of you who don't know, is an inclusive and neutral platform for informed conversations, exchange of ideas, arts, and culture. We're a privately enabled public purpose institution, and we host up to 400 events a year, all of which are free and open to the public. Visit our website for the full shebang. Today's event is Out of the Middling Middle, Navigating the Long and Messy Midlife. So midlife is a phase when we find ourselves pulled in multiple directions across work, home, health, friendships, and hobbies. In this session, Ravi Venkatesan and Deepak Jayaraman delve into the themes from Deepak's new book, Play to Potential. So a key insight of the book is the recognition that life unfolds in seasons, shaped by transitions, some intentional, others unexpected. Using real-life examples and case studies, Deepak illustrates how navigating these transitions thoughtfully is vital to realizing our potential. Today, he's in conversation with Ravi Venkatesan, and then we'll open it up to a large chunk of this evening is going to be interactive, so please hold on to your questions and comments until then. I'll introduce both speakers briefly. The author for the evening, Deepak Jayaraman, has since 2016 hosted the Play to Potential podcast, sharing insights around leadership, transitions, and careers from over 100 distinguished guests across various fields. Before launching his independent practice, Deepak worked with KPMG, McKinsey & Co., and Egon Zehnder in the UK, US, and India. Today, he's in conversation with Ravi Venkatesan, who's a social entrepreneur, business leader, and author. He is the chairman of the Global Energy Alliance for People and Planet, and founder of the Global Alliance for Mass Entrepreneurship and Social Ventures Partners India, and serves on the boards of Rockefeller Foundation and Hitachi Limited.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to welcome all of you to this cozy book event. And I'm particularly delighted to be in conversation with a dear friend, the author Deepak. Deepak and I have known each other for about a decade. We first met when he was at Egon Zehnder. I forget the context, but must have been about something important, which I can't remember now. But Deepak, then I met him again when he joined Social Venture Partners, an organization which I helped start, and some of you are from SVP. And he was volunteering with a small NGO called Antarang, and I believe you continue to this day. A little later, probably 2016, maybe 17, I forget now, Deepak told me he was leaving Egon Zehnder, and I was a bit shocked because it's such a great firm that, you know, nobody leaves it. They just retire. But Deepak was very keen to set up his own advisory to help people who are making transitions get through them elegantly. And about that time, he also told me, look, I've got this idea. I want to start this podcast series called Play to Potential, which turns out to be the title of the book. And he said, look, would you be willing to be in conversation with me? And of course, I immediately said yes, because Deepak, you'll find, is an unusually thoughtful person. Little did I realize that Play to Podcast series would grow to the size it has. As Sandhya mentioned, I think that you've interviewed over 100 people from all over the world, not just India. And it's not just your usual suspects who are CEOs and business leaders and so forth, but Olympic athletes and artists and academics and so forth. And as I was writing my own book some years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I reached out to Deepak because I was looking at the same questions, transitions, what is success, how do you manage careers and all that. And he was deeply insightful. So I said, Deepak, why aren't you writing a book? And he just smiled, because at that time, I don't think you were particularly motivated to write a book. But I was quite pleased that a short while later, he did decide to put down some of his thoughts. So let's start by, Deepak, with a simple question. Who did you write this book for? Who's the target audience? Because we were discussing, look, am I too old for this or am I too young for this? And in sort of a nutshell, what is your message? And finally, what does success look like for this book project?
Thank you, Ravi, first of all, for having me here. It's a wonderful venue, and when Ravi mentioned we should do this, I remember him saying it's a very cozy venue, you'll like it. I can understand why he said that. So thank you all for braving the Bangalore traffic and coming here for the conversation. So maybe a little bit of context before I dive into the question, Ravi. Play to Potential, in a way, when I started the podcast, I wanted to be curious about three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. And in a way, if I go back to Egon Zehnder, most of my conversations with leaders were around transitions. Every client conversation was a leadership transition conversation, and every candidate conversation was a career transition conversation. So somehow I felt I had a window seat to transitions. So when I started this podcast, and just like businesses think about where to play, how to win, in the context of the business strategy, I felt we all are grappling with where to go and how to grow in the context of our respective journeys. So I said, let me try and be curious about these two questions, and let me try and speak to a range of people, not just speak people in business, but there's an opportunity to bring diversity of thought from multiple disciplines. So in a way, that was the origin of the podcast. And back to what Ravi said, 2-3 years back, you know, I've always seen, in my mind, I thought the Play to Potential podcast was a river. It keeps flowing. I didn't see the need to bottle it into a book. But somehow, 2 years back, when I went for my undergrad 25-year reunion, multiple people started asking me, when's the book coming out? And somehow, I'm beginning to believe that people see you better than you see yourself. So I started writing out this book. And initially, to answer your question, the book, I felt, I started writing it for the typical corporate athlete, right? Let's say people in 30s, 40s, 50s who are climbing the ladder, successful in a traditional sense. But then when I hired a coach for myself, a lady called Shweta Mani, who some of the people in the audience know. she pushed me to say, what exactly do you want to write about and what do you mean by potential? And when I thought harder about it, I felt I wanted to expand on the term of potential in a holistic sense. Very often we use the term potential in the workplace to say this person is high potential, low potential, you know. There's a 2x2 matrix that some people draw saying performance potential and so on. But when I thought deeper, I said work just happens to be one of the many things that we, you know, do in our lives. Why should we think about potential and just in the context of work? So I said, why don't I think about potential in a holistic way? And when I thought about who are the people grappling with this sort of the multidimensionality of potential, I realized it's people in the middle, right? And what do I mean by the middle? I think given elongating lifespans, people are living longer and working longer into their 60s and 70s. And given abundance of choice, I think people are getting confused much earlier. Earlier, I think in my father's generation, he was in one bank for 40 years. My father-in-law was an army officer for 35 years. I felt you just got on the highway and kept driving. Today, I feel we are all in places where we need to take many twists and turns. So I think people right very soon after graduating, or even perhaps even at the time of graduating, there's a lot of, given abundance of options, I see a lot of confusion. So in a way, if I look at where is the messy middle, it's somewhere between 25 and 60, right? It's all messy and you know, people are dealing with the variety and the multidimensionality. So I think, Ravi, this book in a way is meant to address people in that whole spectrum, right? It's clearly not for the maybe the person in school or person coming out of college, but somebody who's had a few years of work experience, who understands themselves a little bit, who's got a few choices in front, and who's dealing with the multidimensionality of who's got a family to take care of possibly, then I think the book hopefully has some messages that that will resonate. And what would success look like with the book?
Before that, yes. What's the one sentence message for that audience of 50 to 60?
What's the one sentence message? Wow. I think it's the journey, right? I think if there's one thing I've realized, for a long time I felt I used destination metrics, whether it's wealth or title or tenure or scale or whatever, those kinds of things that I measured. But I feel if there's one thing, if we can find a way of measuring the journey in a meaningful way, then I think we can play the long game with happiness and fulfillment. I think that's the, it's I'm still finding meanings and discovering layers, but that's where my thinking is at this point in time. In terms of what I hope to get done through this book, my attempt through this book is literally, very often I find the human mind is wired to do well in something that you can measure. You know, what gets measured gets managed, as they say in the corporate lingo. So my attempt is to provide sort of a hopefully an intuitive frame or a language that people can use to deal with the multidimensionality of life. I find that very often, because we don't have a language, we struggle to look at these multiple dimensions. In the book, I put out a sort of a framework, if I may, called Flavor, which hopefully gives people some language to look at the multidimensionality of life and take stock, and then, of course, make their own course corrections and choices. But that's my hope with the book, and hopefully more people benefit from it.
Great. Now, this is a complex book about a complex subject, which is life itself. So what I thought might be helpful, Deepak, is if we can unpack some of the main ideas, and the way I'd like to try and do that with you is pick 5 or 6 key words and have you speak to them. And then we'll, you know, bring in the audience. So the first one would be the obvious one, transitions. So, you know, you keep coming back to the idea of transitions. In fact, we were talking before, life is basically punctuated equilibrium. There are brief moments when things are stable and calm and good, but mostly it's in transition. So what are some of the most common transitions that all of us go through? Why are they so, to use your words, messy and difficult? What makes them challenging? And what advice do you have for us who are in the midst of some of these to navigate these transitions more successfully? What have you found to be some helpful approaches, mindsets, or tools?
Thank you, Ravi. I think there are two or three different types of transitions, right? One is just the transitions that happen because of the clock, right? I think there's that childhood. For example, I like the work of Bob Keegan of Harvard, who talks about various phases of adult transition. You know, initially we are children, then we become teenagers, and he calls that the imperial mind, where the teenager believes he or she is the center of the universe. I have a teenager at home, and I can relate to why someone would say that. Then he says, then you move to what's called a socialized mind, which is sort of going through this phase of what will the world think of me, right? In a way, sort of, if I may call it, competing with the Joneses and really saying, you know, a lot of the choices are determined by how the world sees us. And then some people transition to a self-authoring mind, which is saying inside out, this is who I am, this is, this is the kind of person I want to be. And then less than 1% end up in what he calls self-transforming mind, which is people like Mandela and Gandhi and so on. But I think that's sort of one lens through which we can look at transition, which is how we evolve, how our mind evolves. And the other is the biology, right? I think clearly, you know, in the context of women, there's maternity, there's aging, there's empty nesting. Sort of just the passage of time often lends itself to various transitions. And the other is, I think, of course, career-related transitions, right? Every role we change, you move from Cummins to Microsoft, then you move from Microsoft to your current portfolio life, and so on and so forth. That's another, if I may say, layer of transitions. And then there are other personal transitions, right? For example, if I take my instance, things were sort of relatively predictable and were going by script till I was 33. When I was McKinsey in 2008, my father in India got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, because of which I had to come back and take care of his treatment. My wife and I decided to come back with a plan to go back within a year. Then Lehman happened, going back to the US didn't make sense. And suddenly we had to reevaluate our options, decided to stay back, and then Egon's end happened. But just being a case in point to say there's a personal layer of transitions. In some cases there's a loss of a loved one, in some cases there's a separation. So I think suffice to say we are sort of every, to use the phrase punctuated equilibrium, there are more punctuations than equilibrium, yeah, right? If you really look at
it. There are more transitions than stable states.
Exactly. Yeah. So in a way, it seems like a way of life. And one of the people whose work I admire a lot is a gentleman called Bruce Feiler, who's written a wonderful book called Life is in the Transitions, if you want to study. But what he says is every 3 to 4 years, you go through some sort of a meaningful transition. Every 10 years, you go through what he calls a life quake, which really, you know, measures whatever, 7 or 8 on the Richter scale, and really shakes you and then gets you to, for me, my father dealing with his stage 4 cancer was like a life quake. In a way, a lot of things changed. So I think I feel looking at life without looking at transitions would be incomplete, right? So that's, I think, given my professional background and given what I'd observed, I felt one had to have a point of view on that. The second piece, I realize that very often the mental models required to thrive in an equilibrium is often different, slightly different from the mental models required to thrive in a transition. Because in equilibrium, it's a lot about, I feel, efficiency, how to be really good at something, how do you, you know, it's often very predictable, you know, it's sort of rinse repeat kind of things. But transitions come with uncertainty, transitions come with anxiety, transitions come with, fear. So there are a lot of, you need to battle a lot of internal demons because you're not sure how you're going to land on the other side, right? One of the terms that Bruce Feiler uses, which I like, is called shape-shifting, right? We often talk about the word resilience. And resilience, the metaphor people have when they use the word resilience is a shock absorber. You know, if I'm given a shock, do I have the resilience to absorb? He says that very often, that's not quite the case. Very often, to come out of a shock, you need to have a shape-shifting capability. And a beautiful example is COVID, right? COVID was a global shock we all experienced. And we all came to a new normal. We didn't go back to an old normal, right? So just like that, as we go through our life, you always end up with a new normal. You never go back to the old normal. So that requires a sort of a certain comfort with ambiguity, a certain comfort with being fluid about your identities, a certain comfort with how you experiment and take chances, and so on and so forth. So I think that's why I feel, we need to have some sort of a toolkit or a language to deal with transitions for us to navigate life.
Expand on identity. Does it get in the way, or is it actually helpful in these transitions?
I think it depends, but I think more often than not, it gets in the way. I think I like the another person I spoke to in my podcast was a lady called Jennifer Gavi Berger, and she talks about a phenomenon called end of history illusion. And what she says is, at any point in time, we think that we are evolved as we can be in terms of our evolution. So for example, she says, you go and ask a 50-year-old person, who will you be when you're 70? The person will say, yeah, give or take, I'll be similar to who I am. But the same 50-year-old person 30 years back would have been very, very different. That 30-year-old version of that person couldn't have predicted where this 50-year-old would have come. So I think we do a good job of understanding the transitions we've been through in the past, but a very poor job of who we could become. And I think, and she talks about identity. Very often I find we take our identities too literally, and often that can become a cage. Let me take my example, right? My father was a public sector banker, so sort of Saraswati was the approach to Lakshmi, right? You say you work hard and hopefully, you know, you study, and then somehow, hopefully your acads will take you somewhere. So I went to IIT Madras, and when I came into IIM Ahmedabad, the narrative in my head was I'm good at math, I'm good at problem solving, quant, all that stuff. But actually the courses I enjoyed the most were organizational behavior. But the identity I had at that time was I'm a quant geek. So I'll take things like derivatives and options and futures and all the quant stuff, and I did well. But truth be told, I wasn't listening to myself. But subsequently, when I was a McKinsey consultant, when I was looking at options, the typical options I considered were strategic planning roles, head of strategy, sort of venture capital, private equity, the kind of pathways that you would consider. But one of my mentors, a gentleman called Ramesh Mangaleshwaran, looked at me and said, you seem to have a people orientation. Have you thought of executive search? And introduced me to Govind Iyer, who Ravi knows well. And that put me on this path. So I feel sometimes at that time my identity was I'm a consultant, problem solving, horsepower. Those were the narratives in my head. I was blind to other ways of looking at myself. So I think very often I find that we have very narrow identities we use to ourselves. Let me give you another example, right? In the podcast, I spoke to a gentleman called Atul Kasbekar, who's a celebrated photographer in the world of Hollywood. He's known for the Kingfisher calendar and so on and so forth. He was actually interesting backstory. He studied chemical engineering. He went to UDCT, a well-known chemical engineering college in Bombay. And he said, I took chemical engineering because I liked chemistry. But within week one, I realized chemical engineering has got nothing to do with chemistry. Right? So he said he became a successful photographer. And then when he was looking at what next, he said, I was confused because photography was being democratized, you know, given the mobiles and whatever. Now you've got all kinds of fancy features on phones. And he said, my cardiologist, if he gets lucky, can take a wonderful photo and can compete with me. But there's no way I can compete with a cardiologist and do an operation. So it's sort of one-way traffic. People are sort of competing with me on my domain. So he said, how should I think about staying relevant? And one of the family members, he said, looked at me and said, you seem to be a trusted platform in Bollywood, which is a murky industry. Why don't you become the platform on which people collaborate? And he said, platform. Then he said, maybe I can produce movies and, you know, I can create a label or a platform which becomes a symbol of trust, etc. And then he became a producer of movies, and he's one of the producer of the movie Neerja, which won the national award, and so on and so forth. But the point I wanted to make here was his identity was I'm a photographer. But somebody from the outside told him, no, you're much more. You could be a platform. So very often, I think what I've noticed, Ravi, is transformations often come when we can sort of be a little more open with our identities. And very often, people around us see us better than we do. So one of the things I say in transitions is lean into outside and feedback. Because, you know, we might be limited by how we see ourselves.
Great. So I think these are the kinds of things you can explore further in the discussion. So let's move to the second keyword, which is, again, something you spend a lot of time on, which is potential. And it's a word, again, we use frequently. What exactly do you mean by potential? How do I discover my potential? Is it something you're born with, or is it endlessly elastic? So tell us more.
Again, it's a big question.
Oh, by the way, why do we mostly fall well short of our potential, which is a point you make?
I remember one of my coaching conversations with a client. I often ask for feedback, saying, how did it go? And at that time, I was running the podcast. I hadn't started writing the book. And he said, Deepak, you're helping me play to my potential. Are you playing to your potential? So I don't have an answer to that, but it was like hit me like a bazooka. I think I'll share a little bit about my journey with the word potential. Initially, I would say as a school student and also maybe as a nerd, if I may, my first understanding of potential was potential energy and kinetic energy, right? I think there is a, for an object to have a certain level of motion, you need to have a certain potential energy stored. It's either elastic energy or gravitational potential energy. So that was sort of my intuitive understanding. So in a way, the implicit assumption being it's finite, it's stored. Of course, a certain set of things need to happen for it to transform into kinetic energy, which is motion and impact. I would say the second real introduction or the exposure to the word came when I was at Egon Zehnder, right? When we would look at candidates in the context of a search, we'd look at capabilities, three levels, right? Capabilities, which is, experiences, which is what the person has done. Competencies, which is how the person gets things done. And potential, which is really what drives that person. So potential was often used as a marker for how far that person will go, right? There's a lovely quote in the movie, Hindi movie, Deewar, Lambe Race Ka Ghoda, right? It used to describe Amitabh Bachchan. There's a guy who sees the young Amitabh Bachchan polishing shoes and who sees a certain spark and he says, Ye Lambe Race Ka Ghoda, just based on that spark. So in Egon Zehnder, we would say, what are the markers of potential we could look for us to say this is a Lambe Race Ka Ghoda, right, if I may. Is there anybody who doesn't understand a word of Hindi? I must apologize. Okay, oh yeah. So that basically means how far will that person go, right? It's a Bollywood movie which talks about, based on Amitabh Bachchan, just to sort of demystify it. So we would look at things like what gives people energy, how curious are they, how resilient are they, how good are they with people, how good are they at connecting the dots, and we'd form a point of view. So that was my second tryst. I would say one of my podcast conversations was with the tennis legend Vijay Amritraj, and he said a couple of things which really stayed with me. The first story he narrated was his visit to Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon. He said, I visited his home in California, and there was a plaque on the wall which really sort of shook me. He said, very often as parents, we say, sky's the limit for you to fulfill your potential. And he said, that plaque said, who said sky's the limit when I could set my foot on the moon, right? So I think sort of when I sat with it, I felt sort of really potential often is limited by our imagination, our beliefs, and sort of based on constraints we place on ourselves. So technically, it could be infinite. That's sort of point number one. The second example he gave in the same conversation was reference to Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Chief Justice in the US. And when somebody asked him, how would you like to be remembered when you're no more? He's known to have said, I want to be remembered as he did what he could with what he had. And I think I find it very powerful because we all have a certain hand of cards that we are playing with, right? And what do I mean by that? We are born into a certain family, a certain financial context. We make some life choices, siblings, spouse, children, whatever, right? Things happen to us. And the question we have to solve is, given the cards I have, what is the best game I can play, right? For a long time, I went through this trap of, I'm this batch of this from this class, this college. But I realized that if we were 200 people from the batch of IMA, each of the 200 has a different set of cards, different set of skills, different set of context. So I think that's the second paradigm which stayed with me to potential. And the last point I might make, once again, came from somebody I spoke to who said, when I asked the question, what does the term play to potential mean to you? When I wrap up the podcast, I asked the question. He said, the answer is in your title. You can't work to your potential. You can only play to your potential. And to me, that was really powerful because in a way, it's sort of closely tied to, you know, who we are. So I think if I go back to Egon Zehnder, take my example, you know, a bulk of my job was evaluating candidates, right? I remember Govind asking me about 3 years in, 4 years in, what were the high points last year as a search consultant? And a good search consultant who's enjoying his or her job would say, when I placed this candidate or when I won this mandate, I remember telling Govind, my high point was when I counseled a candidate on his career, and he later sent me an email saying, this is the most insightful career transition conversation I've had with any search consultant. To which Govind said, wonderful, but that's not how we make money as a search firm. The point being, I realized at that time was what felt like play for me was a footnote in a search consultant's job. So I realized that that was probably not the canvas in which I could play. That felt like work. So in a way, that was one of the reasons I transitioned to what I do now, where I feel who I am and what I do. There's a certain resonance, which sort of, in a way, I think helps me access a certain reservoir of energy, which otherwise can be draining. So I don't know if that directly answers the question, potential, Ravi, but those are some of the thoughts around potential
I
have.
How do you go about discovering your potential, because it's infinite in your
true
words?
I think my take on this, Ravi, is we all strive to play to our potential. Whether we play to it or not, the jury is out, and I think we are often very poor judges of how far. So I think, to me, I don't want to get caught in the nitty-gritties of how much of the potential you're unlocking. But I think if we strive to move in that direction, I feel that's a life worth living, is my stance on it. And I think one of the pieces, as I said earlier, I feel, I think a big piece of the puzzle, you know, if I go back to the metaphor of journeys being more like highways about 30, 40 years back, now I think they're more like mazes, right? I think we've spoken about this as well, Ravi. And I feel if I take the metaphor of an automobile, for you to sort of do well on a highway, you need a good horsepower, a vehicle with a good horsepower. But if you have to navigate through a maze, I think the steering wheel becomes much more important than the horsepower. And to me, that steering wheel is self-awareness. Self-awareness. And I think what I've also come to discover is there are two pieces to self-awareness. Very often when we say self-awareness, it's often, you know, there's one stream around internal self-awareness. Again, this is based on the work of a lady called Tasha Urich, who's written a wonderful book called Insight, which sort of really goes deep into self-awareness. But the crux of what she says is there's internal self-awareness, which is around mindfulness, meditation, reflection, pausing, you know, all that stuff that we do. And in a way, India is the place where a lot of this thinking started, right? This whole, you know, if you really go back to the Vedas and the sort of the Bhagavad Gita and all those texts. So I think there's a piece around internal self-awareness. But I feel the piece that gets much less commentary is the piece around external self-awareness. I feel the people around us, our family, the various people in the ecosystem we interact with, often see us with a certain level of granularity and insight, and not tapping into it is a missed opportunity. So I think back to fulfilling our potential, I feel if I look at some of the big breaks I've been through and some of my clients going through, I feel it's been based on them listening into the whispers of the people around them and really reflecting. And of course, the idea is to marry the two, right? In a way, I would say the internal and external self-awareness, treat them as X and Y axes. So if you get a good scatter plot, then you're able to understand yourself better in a more granular fashion. And then if you can sort of use that as a steering wheel and make choices, I feel you end up in a better place. Mm. That's my take on that.
Good. I notice we're already half an hour into the conversation and we haven't brought the audience in, but let's just focus on one more word and then open up, and that is success. It's just such an important idea in our world, in our times. You've interviewed over 100 wildly successful people. You've placed many successful people. Your success yourself. So tell us more about how to think about success. There's a very fashionable idea right now, which is called Ikigai, which is you're supposed to navigate and swim towards this intersection between what you're good at, what you love, and what the world cares about. But in reading your book, I sort of noticed that you don't find it particularly helpful. And so you throw that out in favor of your own framework of flavor. So maybe this is a good time to talk about flavor, which is, I think, quite a central aspect of your book. And then let's get the audience in.
Sure. I think before I get to the ikigai point, Ravi, maybe they are connected. But success, I think this, I touched upon it a little earlier. Growing up, I felt, you know, as a school student, academic achievement was seen as success, right? Getting somewhere. It always was framed as a destination metric, you know, whether it's scores, whether it's achievement, whether it's getting somewhere. And I think even through my years at McKinsey and Egon Zehnder, I felt, you know, that was sort of the paradigm, that was sort of the narrative around me. But I think given the work I do, my current definition of success is anchored more around journey metrics. You know, I feel success often is about leading life in a certain way, and then often success takes care of itself. So rather than a certain destination, which often by definition is a moving target.
That sounds very clear.
I would say, why don't I maybe move to the ikigai discussion, and then in a way it informs the point of view on this. So I think, as you said, Ravi, ikigai, I find it useful. I don't have a problem with it, but I have a problem with how it's often been interpreted. It's a bit like a telescope can't do the job of a microscope. You know, sometimes when we have a tool, it's important to know what the tool is meant to do and not apply it in the wrong context. I find a lot of people using a screwdriver as a spanner, right? So that's my problem with ikigai. So personally for me, when I was moving out at Egon Zehnder, thinking a little bit about, you know, what I enjoyed, what the opportunity was, etc., those four circles helped. But when I look around, I find that a lot of people find it like Mount Everest. You know, I find that life is quite messy for it to neatly fit four circles. So I think I just therefore wanted to ensure that people at least take it with a pinch of salt. So, you know, one of my friends sent me this beautiful quote. When I was discussing this idea with a friend of mine, Venkatesh Srinivasan, who some people here know, he sent me a quote from the movie Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, from the movie Steven Spielberg made about him, where he says, somebody questions him about his principles, right? Lincoln suggests something which seems devious, but the objective is pure. He says, so the person countering Lincoln says, what about your true north? What about your principles? He says, a compass will point you to the true north, but a compass often doesn't have direction for the swamps and the chasms and the ravines that you will encounter along the way. So in the pursuit of the true north, if you just jump into a well, there's no glory in it. So ikigai, I think it's useful to have it at true north, but it's useful to know, for example, follow your passion. Now, if you don't have food on the table, I like to play the guitar, right? If I sort of said after Egon Zehnder, I'm going to sit and learn the guitar, I think that would have been the wrong answer for my family, right? Because there's no commercial model in it. So I think somewhere we all live in a certain context. There are expectations, there are constraints, there are financial realities that we need to be aware of. So that's why I find taking it literally sometimes can lead to negative outcomes. So that's my disconnect with ikigai. So I the approach I propose, maybe if I could just spend a couple of minutes just laying it out. So as I thought about it, I felt, and when I think about potential in a multidimensional sense, I propose a certain approach which seems to empirically fit a lot of people who seem to be having impactful, happy, and fulfilled lives. One piece is, I think there's an element of family. I think a lot of literature around treats life as a solo sport. But the more I look around, when I look at choices people make, when I look at the various decisions and macro choices often anchored around family. They're not made in a solo context. So I think tuning into a family context, I think, is paramount. Because if we are sort of, to use a musical context, it's like the bass note on which the melody of life is played, right? If you play a melody which is not consistent with the bass note, it'll be jarring, right? That's the way I see it. So what do I mean by family context, right? It could be financial context. For example, if my father happens to be a billionaire, then I have a different set of choices to make. Then maybe I can sit and play the guitar and do something if it brings me joy. But if it's not the case, then I need to put food on the table, and that changes the set of options. So I think there's a financial context. And even in a home, there are situations where two people are working, that's one context. There are situations where maybe one person is earning, then the other person often has the luxury of pursuing the passion without the financial pressure, but that's a conversation to be had, and that context varies from house to house, right? So I think there's a family context. There are transitions that are happening in the family. Let's say kids go to college, suddenly there are fewer variables, and therefore maybe, you know, a homemaker who might have made some choices for the children suddenly can make different set of choices if that constraint is removed. So there's a family context, number one. Number two, I think people leading a full, I believe playing to full potential, make space for something that they truly love. And Ikigai, of course, says that if you can find it in the workplace, that's wonderful. But when I look around, once again, a small percentage of people have the luxury of finding it in the work. But a lot of them, I find, have another pursuit. For me, it's playing music with the children. For some, it's gardening. For some, it's golf. For some, it's theater. For some, it's pottery. But I think something that replenishes you and makes you shows up, makes you show up in a more energized way the next morning, right? So that's the second. The third piece I talk about is aspiration and not necessarily ambition. I find ambition to be a single unidimensional variable. To say I want to be, you know, either financial metric, I want to be worth X million dollars, or I want to sort of become an MD by this age, or I want to build a unicorn, whatever, right? Very often, that's often seen as ambition. But I find, back to the discussion we had, Ravi, about identities, if we can have an aspiration across our various identities, and I discuss that in chapter 8 of the book, where I say there's a certain approach I suggest where we are mindful of the various identities we carry. And if we can sort of take baby steps to move each of these identities forward, then I think it could, you know, if we can sort of make aspiration across these identities, it could be powerful, right? What kind of a father do you want to be? What kind of a son do you want to be? What kind of a spouse do you want to be? What kind of a coach do you want to be? What kind of a musician do you want to be? So I think there's an opportunity for us to be mindful of our various identities. That's aspiration. The next piece is in the context of work, right? Even the world of work is changing. And I think back to the long lives we all will lead, I feel we all need to go through this, if I call it the talent market dating process, right? Very often when you work in one company, it becomes like arranged marriage, right? You got a job and then you don't need to go through a dating process. And that actually can be quite unnerving for a lot of people, especially, for example, when you retire. Let's say you've been in one company, and Ravi, I'm sure you meet a lot of people with that sort of a profile. Now, how do you really take stock of what your skills are, where they can be applied, and how do you really add value, and what the opportunities? And that has to be cooked. There's no ready job description waiting to be written to figure out, you know, the world will not hold a meeting to find your worth. I forget who had that quote. But I think the world is not going to sit somewhere and make a JD for you so that you can apply for a job. We all have to craft it. So I think there is a, at every level, right? Even a homemaker, for example, back to the how to be of value and seek opportunity. I say that even in situations where, let's say, one earning member in the family and the other spouse is sort of playing the role of a homemaker, then I find that if they completely pivot towards the family, family can be a low gratitude and a low feedback environment, and it can often lead to self-worth issues. So I say that even in those situations, find a way of being of value, whether it's volunteering, maybe teaching a few kids, maybe it's painting. Then I find that very often they show up differently in relationships. So I think that's the next piece. Family, love, aspiration, and how do you really be of value and seek opportunity, sort of the talent market dating process. The next two pieces are sort of, in a way, the intangible balance sheets, right? One is sort of invest in yourself, which is physical health, mental health, spiritual health, and also capabilities and self-awareness, right? In a way, if we are going to play the long game, I think that becomes a key part of the puzzle. Otherwise, there's a risk of burnout. I mean, we've heard about the 90-hour discussion, right? I think nobody's talking about the long game, but that's my disconnect. So that's invest in yourself. And the last piece is relationships. And relationships, of course, there's enough research to say people who are happy when they age are people with social connections because they're an important part. But I also feel relationships are a key variable in opportunities, and especially during transitions. Very often, the opportunities come through relationships, not through a portal, right? So I think they are a key part of shape-shifting and becoming something else. So the word that emerged for me was flavor, right? Family, love, aspiration, VO, invest in yourself, and R. And I won't say it's a straight line, but it's more of a circle, right? These are all interconnected. So just like how a company needs to have a coherent business model, I feel we all need to have a coherent flavor and make a set of choices which are consistent to our context. And in the middle, I would say, is how do we rediscover our flavor as the seasons change? Right? My flavor in my 20s is different from my flavor in my 40s. And each one of us, life is not static. That was my other issue with Ikigai. It sort of suggests a static answer. But as we roll through life, we just need to keep rediscovering our flavor as we go through life. So going back to the first part of the question, Ravi, I feel a sort of playing to potential is about living a flavorful life, which in a way sort of is about the journey and not the destination. So I think that's where my thinking is right now.
Super. Now I notice we have keen competition from phones. So in order to, let's get the audience in. And so, yes. Oh, no, I wasn't looking at you in particular. but look, he said a lot. I think there's some rich ideas out here. And many of us were talking as before this session started. I'd encourage you to open up, share your own truth, or ask your own question. More than likely, it's something that's relevant to many of us. So I'm going to now fade into the background and let you have fun with the audience, play to potential.
Thank you.
One is, relating whatever, a lot of interesting ideas, I've also been inspired a lot by Ravi's book on what the heck are you doing with your life. So one of the things is potential is, to me, it keeps changing at every point. And we also go through ups and downs. Sometimes we feel, I can do a lot, what the hell am I doing with my life? That's one. Second is, if you look at it, one of the interesting questions we ask when we conduct some workshops and all this, what percentage of your potential do you think have you realized? Okay, this brings a lot of interesting discussions. And things like, for example, Swami Vivekananda says, every soul is potentially divine. So when you look at it from this angle, I feel I'm falling short. I'm not doing something big I can achieve, but I can't. But on the other side, within the constraints and all, I need to be contented and be happy with what I've achieved. So this conflict, we keep going through that all the time. So the question is, should I be contented with what I've achieved? Or should I look for, my potential is something huge, I've done only so little.
Yeah? So Deepak, one choice you have is whether you want to take 2-3 questions at a time.
Sure.
That's your choice.
I think it's a good idea to maybe have, thank you, maybe a couple more. Sure.
The concept of flavors, right, that is, from what I remember, it comes from quantum mechanics. Quarks, are defined in, it's different flavors. Were you inspired from, did you take any inspiration from that?
That's an easy one, actually. That's a binary answer. No is the honest answer. In a way, quantum mechanics was actually the third semester of physics, and actually it was a challenging subject. So no. I wish I had the ability to process the complexity of quantum mechanics, but the answer is no. It's more a coincidence than inspiration.
Hi. Sorry. Deepak, I had a question to you. When you start analyzing people, you have this regular discussions every 6 months as to where does a person working with you go in, and how do you discover the potential where he goes in, right? Or he or she goes in. See, more often than not, I think leaders are never kind of trained or never brought out to determine what is the potential of a person. And different, we always look at what are the deliverables, engineering, et cetera, et cetera. then what I felt was when I was leading Harman, there's a guy from Amsterdam who came in and he was working with me for 9 months. And at the end of the 9 months, he was a very good electronics engineer. And at the end of the 9 months, I went to introduce him to A.R. Rahman, because A.R. Rahman was my brand ambassador. And then he went on to a completely different level of having to look at doing synthesis of South Indian classical music with fusion music, and he went off. And then he's now in L.A. doing something else. The question to you is, I have not read your book, and therefore I must confess I don't know what is in the book, is how do we really get our leaders to start analyzing the potential of the people with whom we are working?
Maybe I'll take this one. So, Lakshmi, thanks for coming. I think there are a couple of lenses through which we can look at potential, I feel. One is potential in the context of a role that somebody's playing. Very often I find that the narratives are saying, let's say, if a person is playing a MD role or a head of operations role, and the discussion happens around potential, it's often saying this is what the role requires, this is what the person is doing, and the person has the potential to do much more. You know, it's often reference to a role. But I feel another vector around which we can think of potential is potential for what? You know, given this is the person, who he or she is, their wiring, their skills, their superpowers, you know, what is the canvas on which they could go and paint? Somewhere I feel that discussion is often not had. It's often implicitly said, this is the canvas. Now, in this canvas, what's the maximum potential you can show? So to me, I feel the opportunity is to have the other conversation about, you know, very often when people are in transition, when I'm sort of working with them, one of the questions I ask the people, you know, around them is, you know, blank sheet. Given who this person is, and their networks, and their capabilities, and their intrinsics, and their beliefs, and their, you know, motivators, you know, what are the kinds of canvases where they will go and paint? And it's going back to a little bit of that photographer situation. Maybe something very different emerges, like production or something else. So to me, that's the, I feel, if we can sort of open up the canvases as well, then I feel we can unlock many more journeys and fulfill many more people's potential. That's sort of the, we could go on, but that's sort of the one thing that emerges. And to your question about that sort of, if I may say, contentment versus restlessness, towards fulfilling the infiniteness of potential, I would say my take on that, again, nowhere still work in progress in terms of understanding the Indian sort of in Indic wisdom. But I would say as long as the restlessness is productive, I find that sometimes it can lead to, you know, there's entropy, which is sort of random energy and sort of restlessness and sort of can be destructive to the people around. But if that, it sort of acts as a helpful fuel to propel forward and discovery, then I think it's useful energy. So I would say contentment, yes, there is a risk of settling too soon and not fulfilling your potential, yes. But that doesn't mean that even if you've, I think there's an opportunity for us to, I think there's a space to be equanimous. You know, one of the people I spoke to, a gentleman called Raghu Anantanarayanan, described Roger Federer. And sort of he said at his peak, there's a certain tranquility about him and he's ready for the next moment. There's a certain intensity, but within that intensity, there's a certain tranquility. So I would say, I don't have a clean answer to the question, but I feel as long as it's a bit like positive stress versus negative stress, right? As long as that restlessness is helpful energy to move you in a certain direction and is helpful to the context you're in, I think it's good. But if it's sort of that restlessness is causing very often in transitions, to take a very specific example, when people are between jobs, sometimes they sort of get too restless and, you know, the children get stressed, the spouse gets stressed, and the whole system ends up in a worse place, then that's not good for the context. So I think as long as you keep the context in mind, if it moves the context forward, then I think that's that usefulness. There's a usefulness to that restlessness. That's the way I see it.
Can I please maybe add, I'm not the author.
No, you should.
One of my favorite quotes is by Carl Jung, and he said many wonderful things, but the one that I particularly like, he says, look, there are three acts in a person's life. He said a man's life because, you know, it was gender insensitive language in those days, but he said there are three acts in a person's life. The first is when he sets out to conquer the world. That's the young you. Then the next act is when you realize that the world will not be conquered, but the likes of you. And the final act is making peace with it. So think about life in these three. And the midlife crisis is when you come to the realization that you're not going to be conquering the world. And yeah, I really love this. And that, so when you come to that third act then of making peace with it is I think when you have to figure out how to find that contentment. That striving is in that first and second phase. And so yeah, I found that to be particularly helpful. I don't know if anybody else likes it, but I loved it.
And I think building on that, contentment doesn't mean lack of initiative to make a difference. So I think they can coexist. Very often see people see this as a either or, but I think that you could be contented but still strive to have an impact and to make a difference. So.
I'm glad you segued into transition because that was a question I had on as we're kind of dealing through with change. It could be getting a new job, going abroad for a master's, but with change, it takes grit and gumption. So there's intent in proving yourself, giving it your all, but there's also inertia because it's fear of the unknown, right? You don't know what you're signing up for. So I'm someone with a very low risk appetite, and I found myself in situations where there's intent. You want to go ahead, pursue, because you want to play to your potential, but inertia comes in the way because you don't know if you can be the best at what you're signing up for. So how does one navigate where you want to do it, but there's something holding you back?
Great question. What's your name, sorry?
My name is Vandana.
Vandana. I think personally, I feel there's a certain mental model when it comes to transitions that we are often used to. That's of a trapeze artist. You know, when you finish your 12th, you often have the, you know, admission into a college. When you finish your college, you often have an admission for master's or a job, and so on and so forth. Of course, the job market looks a little different these days. But the point I'm making is the metaphor of transitions that people often have in mind is cling on to the next trapeze before I let go of the current one. But the more journeys I study, real breakthrough often comes when people are willing to take a leap of faith into the unknown, right? When I spoke to Bruce Feiler on my podcast, he referenced a scene from the movie Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where Harrison Ford needs to take a leap of faith. Again, if you want to sort of go back home and just go to YouTube, it's a beautiful 2-minute clip. Just say Indiana Jones leap of faith, where he has to go and get some, to put it in simple terms, some medicinal herb that will heal Sean Connery, right? His father, who's sort of really having some, he's bleeding, right? So I think, and that leap of faith, unfortunately, And the paradox here being the path appears only when you take the leap, right? You don't see the bridge when you put your foot. And there is, it's like bungee jumping, right? You will feel butterflies in the stomach, and that's part of the process. And I agree. If I look at myself, let me take my example, right? The background I come from, entrepreneurship was far away. My father worked in a public sector bank, and the narrative in my home was, don't ever go to the private sector because you never know, you might lose your job tomorrow. In a public sector organization, nobody can chuck me. I have my job for life and pension for life. That's the narrative. So that's the risk sort of context I come from. So when I moved from Egon Zehnder and I sort of had to take that plunge, I wasn't sure if this pathway would commercially make sense. And this is where I have to credit my wife, Kamini, who said, okay, let's have a stop loss. Do this for a period of 12, 18 months. Worst case, come back to a treadmill, right? In a sense, it's not the end of the world. So I think the point here, Vandana, is maybe who can provide a little bit of that. When I say safety net, it could be a psychological safety net. It could be a commercial safety net. So I think that the limited point I'm making is sometimes the leap cannot be avoided because only beyond the leap, there is opportunity. And the paradox is till you let go of the trapeze, the next one doesn't emerge. For example, one of our batchmates, one of my classmates from IMA is here. He was a sales and marketing executive in P&G in Singapore. But sort of he felt it wasn't moving him, it wasn't meaningful for him when he turned 30, 35. So he came back to Pathankot in Punjab. His father was a teacher. So he just toured the country, just doing some programs with his father, just took a break. Long story short, today he runs a unicorn called Lead along with his wife, which provides edtech solutions to companies. And he says that that 6 month break I took with nothing in hand really gave me the space to really think about what mattered to me and where my energy can be put to good use, and the potential emerged. So again, all of us have to be true to our context and the constraints. So I'm not saying everybody has the luxury of taking a sabbatical, but I would say if you can architect a safety net of sorts, then it makes it a little easier to take that leap of faith. That's my...
I think there's a lot of interest. You might want to aggregate questions.
Sure. Maybe the next 2-3 questions.
Maybe the lady and then...
Thank you for the insights shared by both of you so far. My question is in the context of career transitions, and from the inside out, there is this psychologist called Brooklyn Durr who spoke about career anchors, that we have different anchors at different stages of our career. We start with getting ahead in our 20s, then maybe getting secure, building for the family, building for the future, then maybe getting balanced when we're juggling different things, then maybe getting high when we're looking at a particular interest. So would career transitions occur as a result of shifting of these anchors, and when we feel that ground shift in terms of what is anchoring us and what is important to us in why we lead our career the way we do, does that then play out in making career transitions and vice versa?
Thank you. Maybe a couple more questions and then we can...
So my question is in the context of managing the transitions, right? So we talked about the multi-dimensional journeys that we live. My reflection is that there are at least 4 parts to it, right? The personal life, everything to do with our family, friends, and all of that. The professional life, that's me, my intellect, my academics, what am I achieving? That's the professional aspect. Then there's the societal life, what's the impact I can leave behind? Then there's the spiritual quest or the spiritual dimension as well, right? Like, so I'm in my early 40s. The question here is that, you know, how do I manage the transitions across these multiple dimensions, given that there are a lot of variables across each of them? How much of controls do we really have? Thank you.
Maybe one more question and then we can...
Hopefully a simple question. You said that lead a full life. By the time we fill one glass, the glass size becomes bigger, and even the bottles become bigger. So how do we kind of, you know, call it as a full? When do we call it as full?
I think this one's a little bit like the infiniteness of potential, right? So I think it's a journey. But the idea is to sort of not get consumed by one element of life. I mean, the simple way in which I articulate it is it's a bit like exam. You know, it's if you've got 6 subjects, just focusing on math is not going to cut it. At some level, you also need to do well in the exam as a whole. So I think the limited point I make is, can we sort of stay true to the various identities we carry and sort of be multidimensional? So I think that's the, and I agree, it's a moving target. It's not, it's never, you're never done, right? I think that's a part of evolution and becoming, if I may. I think, ma'am, and then I'll come to your question in the end. I think my sense on transitions, you spoke about career anchors, right? I think what drives transitions, I think there are different elements, right? I think career anchors is one of them. Again, I don't want to get wedded into one paradigm. Sometimes it's personal context which drives transitions. Sometimes it's not even your transition, right? For example, if it's dual careers, maybe, you know, your wife has a promotion and she has to relocate and then you follow, right? Or vice versa. So I think there are... And sometimes kids get admission into some school and then that drives somebody. I know a friend of mine whose child got into a certain college and then they said, okay, maybe I can apply to that office of this organization. So I think there are multiple factors which drive transitions, right? So it's not just the work and the content and the career anchors. Of course, they are one variable, but at least I would like to submit that let's be open to the various forces which might lead to transitions. Some are choices we make and some are choices that are forced upon us because of the circumstances. That's my submission. And to your point, I like the work of Professor Stuart Friedman in Wharton, and he talks about 4 domains: self, work, home, and community, right? Work, you spoke about. Home is the immediate family, and community is sort of that societal impact. But very often I find people don't invest enough in themselves, because in a way, unless we replenish that reservoir, if there's a risk of sort of generosity burnout, as some people call it out. So I think, and the idea is not to have everything transitioning at the same time, right? I think there's only so much appetite we have to deal with a certain transition, a certain dimension. So I think there's an opportunity to be thoughtful about what variables we change at a point in time. So not to change too many things at the same time, but in a way, hopefully just being aware of these various dimensions can hopefully help us lead a full life. What happens is let's say we change a job, then sometimes it's very easy to pour ourselves into the new job and get consumed by it and forget the various other facets. So I think the limited point is to sort of ensure we don't lose sight of the multidimensionality and get consumed by one element of transition.
Hello, Deepak, and hello, Ravi. I've been, an avid follower of your podcast, Deepak. In fact, as I drove down, I was listening to your parenting podcast, and that's where you talked about the reference to Roger Federer.
Yes.
And Ravi, your book was really a breath of fresh air during the COVID. What the heck do I do with my life? So I've picked up a lot of insights from both your work, and Deepak, Spotify informs me that I've spent like a whole lot of hours listening to your podcast, and I did that when I was walking. So it was a best of both the worlds, walking as well as insights. So thank you for that. So I just had one question, which also alludes to something that Ravi, you had mentioned in your work, which is the concept of multiple careers or multiple vocations or whatever we call it. Because I think, yes, now that our longevity is increased or will increase to 90 or more, my mother recently passed away at 90, so, we are the next generation with, if luck goes our way, and then maybe I'll also live to be 90. And what do we do until then, right? We have this big yawning gap from now till then. So what do you have to say to the whole idea of keeping multiple careers alive? So I myself have transitioned from the corporate sector to the development sector, and then I'm right now transitioning, as well as I have a creative side. So I just wanted to know how feasible it is, because I don't see it in the formal workspace being recognized, because a lot of workplaces also have this thing about not being, kind of doing anything else or whatever. So what is your what are the current workplace trends telling us about that, or what is right? Yes, thank you.
You want to take a look? No, I think we should take a few more questions.
Sure.
Hi, Deepak.
Hi.
I managed to drag along a friend of yours. So I've been reading a book, excellent read. Thank you. And the question I had was a little bit linked into the book. They have a chapter called What Lies Beneath, right? And there are lots of questions that you pose in that.
Yes.
What's a way to tackle those questions? Because one option, obviously, is to probably go to a coach. If you're trying to do it on your own, I feel like I might be having my own biases or in my own white page. So what's a way to kind of tackle that so that you keep it open as well as, if you don't have a coach? Yeah.
Got it. Maybe one more question and then two more.
Hi, Deepak. Hi, Ravi. So it is interesting you mentioned Bruce Feller. So I loved his book, Life Transitions and Life Quakes. And sometimes I feel like my life has seen too many quakes. Okay. And I also loved the metaphor of sailing. Okay, but then it's like car which is getting hit from multiple sides, and every time you have to change totally different choices. Okay. So how do you deal with that? What's it?
Thank you.
So thank you. The most takeaway point for me was identity being cage and how we should keep it loose. My question is, while we are transitioning, I have also transitioned many times. What's the playbook? We have interviewed so many people. What is their playbook when they are transitioning? What do they do to launch themselves into this new career? Like, are they getting into some new group or reading books, or what are the things? And also, I missed the thing. and about how the world is itself is transitioning towards AI. Now, Ravi was also telling his new book mentioned about AI. So I am asking here is, how are we relevant right now, the people sitting here who are already in the middle age, and the world is already seeing the new talent irrelevant? What are your points and takeaways there?
Wow. Let me address them in no particular order. I think first maybe the what lies beneath. I forget your name. Rohan. Thank you. And hi, Vikram. I think the couple of thoughts, Rohan. One is I feel the reason I have those questions in that chapter four of the three of the book is because I find when we look at self-awareness, very often people default to strengths and development areas, you know, because that's probably what the corporate years of corporate training does to people. So they reflect on these are my strengths, these are self-awareness. But I feel there are other dimensions of getting to know ourselves. When do we come alive? What feels like play? You know, what are the circumstances where we lose ourselves? What are our superpowers? You know, what does the highlights reel of our life look like? You know, when were we at our best? So I think there's an opportunity to sort of open up that box in terms of the vectors of inquiry, even if it comes to self. And I think in the various conversations I've had, if there's one, of course, there's this whole set of practices around, you know, meditation, mindfulness, breath work, and so on. If there's one practice that I feel empirically has emerged as something that differentiates, you know, people who've done significant inner work from the rest is journaling. I find that a lot of them have some sort of a journaling practice where they spend some time just jotting it down. One of the people I spoke to was a gentleman called Rich Fernandez, who runs this institute called Search Inside Yourself. It was incubated in Google. Now it's a not-for-profit, and they do self. They said Google helps people search the world, but how do we search inside ourselves? So the program was cheekily called Search Inside Yourself. And he says journaling is almost like running a version update on yourself. He says every time you journal, and he suggests that you take a pen and paper. Actually, there's something to the mechanics of putting pen and paper, or maybe the speed of writing, which apparently makes a difference to the way the brain gets rewired, which every time we journal, we sort of morph into the next version update of ourselves. So I think the point I wanted to make was, I suggest if you can marry that internal self reflection with external feedback. Now, external feedback, you don't need to have a coach. Sometimes you can just maybe send a survey out, or maybe have conversations with people. You know, one of the things I've seen people do, especially when they're in transitions, is to go and talk to a few people around them to say, in the podcast, for example, Rupa Kudwa was one of the leaders who transitioned from Crisil to heading Omidyar Network. She said, once I decided I wanted to move on, I went and spoke to 45 different people. You know me, where do you think I will thrive? You know, what are the circumstances where I'm at my best? And slowly, negative clarity emerges. You know what you don't want to do. And then at some point, positive clarity emerges. So I think those are the few thoughts in that context. And I think the sir behind... Umesh. I think the answers are contextual. I think you did talk about, you know, the steering wheel and life quakes and so on. I think very, very sometimes it's useful to ask for support, for somebody to, you know, understand what is going on and suggest what are the different pathways possible. It's a, you know, since it's a very contextual discussion, it's hard for me to suggest answers. But sometimes when solutioning becomes hard, I think now we are living in a world where I think it's okay to ask for help. It's almost like if one has diabetes, we go and ask for a doctor, for, you know, a specialist to help us. So one thought that emerges is, if there are too many variables and too many life quakes, maybe ask a friend, maybe there's an opportunity to get professional help for somebody to understand your context and then help you with the way forward. That seems like what's emerging for me at this stage. I think we had one more question on, I forget the third question, that careers. Multiple careers, right? I think, Ravi, I'd love your thoughts as well on this, but I think I genuinely think the sort of the corporate pathway is designed for, at this point of time, designed for whatever, 20 to 60, right? I don't think it has really grasped the 100-year life phenomenon, the 90-year, 100-year life phenomenon yet. So I feel the onus is on us to go through that dating process. Now, people like Ravi, I mean, I'm still in my late 40s, but people like Ravi, in my view, are role models in terms of how they go on the dating process, right? Mm-hmm. To really I'd love for him to talk. But what I see people do effectively is really being aware of what your resources are, your networks, what gives you joy, what gives you energy, what is the kind of impact you want to have. And then back to the flavor, the relationships. Once you have conversations, I feel opportunities emerge. For some, it might be board members. For some, it might be volunteering somewhere. For some, it might be one full job. For example, earlier today, you know, we were both part of Social Venture Partners. One of the people I spoke to today was a leader in the tech industry in Concentrix. Today, he's at Plaksha University because he said, I want to give back and I want to make a difference. So the real question to ask is, how can I be of value and how do I seek that opportunity? And some of it, not everything has to be a job or paid for. Very often people get to this point and some of the financial needs have been met. Then you're really saying, how can I make a difference? And how can I be of value in line with what brings me joy and what energizes me? So I do think it's important for us to, you know, my father-in-law, for example, is a retired army officer, right? When he retired from the army as a brigadier, my mother-in-law and my wife tells me that it was a tough few months till he found himself to be interested in geopolitics. And then he started writing in journals and magazines, and then, you know, people started reaching out to him, and then he was able to contribute and have discussions and found a space which was in line with what gave him joy. But equally enough of his batchmates who were brigadiers in the army retired and haven't really filled the time with anything meaningful, or they haven't really been deliberate about how they can interact with the world and be of value. And you can see that their self-worth is declining, health is declining, and, you know, things go south. So I'm a believer in multiple careers. The real question is, what are our assets, what do we want, and how do we engage in that process? Ravi, you've lived that life.
No, not me, but I lived it. I've thought a lot, spoken to a lot of people, and I think we need to have a reframing, which is, in the 21st century, there's no such thing as a stable job and a career. The idea of a job is almost dead. It's a 20th century idea, which is going to be relevant and applicable to fewer and fewer people. And there's no such thing as a predictable long career of the sort that you talk about, 20, 30 years. I would encourage everybody to think about life, work life, as a series of projects and also a portfolio of projects. Okay? I think that's a much more constructive, practical way of thinking about it. And a project may last 2 years or 5 years, but don't fall into the delusion that you have a long career with this company or organization. Okay? And very quickly, you need to learn to be self-employed. Not everybody wants to be an entrepreneur or will be successful as an entrepreneur starting a business, but almost every one of us in the 21st century has to learn to stand on our own two feet, be good at something, and, you know, use that to make money. And you have to think about this portfolio of things. So you do some things that pay you money and put food on the table. Other things give you joy. Something gives you meaning and purpose, and you have to assemble this. I've written a lot about that. And finally, I would say, you can't think your way into these answers. You have to feel your way experientially. So if you're at that crossroads, then what I'd suggest is try different things, and, you know, you'll figure out which pathways are meant for you and so forth. But it's a very, very different mindset and approach than the past. And finally, I would say it feels scary when you're just starting down that path. You know, after you've made one or two transitions, it's going to, you'll wonder why you were ever stuck in that cage before. I have an eye on the clock, Deepak, and so maybe I'll pose one or two last questions to you. There's no AI in your book.
I wasn't looking for venture funding.
No. So, yeah, one of my thoughts was, do you have any ideas on how do you play to your potential in an AI world where things are changing so fast and so dramatically? What would you say?
It's a good question, Ravi, and I haven't thought deeply about it yet. It's definitely, it's been on my mind to sort of go on a path of inquiry around this, so don't want to feign expertise on a topic I'm not an expert at. But I think in a way, I feel, the time horizon of relevance, I feel, I have a feeling is getting shorter and shorter. Earlier, if you were a good carpenter, you could sort of say, okay, I'll be a good carpenter and sort of do this for so many years. Today, I'm just using that as a loose example. We all have competencies in certain domains. But I feel, I think there's one wave of AI implication to say, a bunch of jobs, et cetera, careers, et cetera, are going to be, changed and made redundant. So I think just if some of us are in that area where there's a risk of that automation really taking our job away or taking a big chunk of our job away, then I think the real question to ask is, what does that mean for me, my career, and how do I really stay relevant? And, and very often I see the discussion framed as man or machine, but I feel if we can sort of make it as a man plus machine. So the real question to me is, how can I, for example, Ravi, as I was walking in, one of the things, and I have my brother-in-law Murli here as well, and he's told me as well that you should think of a bot. What stops you? You've had these 100 conversations in the podcast. What stops you from feeding them into an AI bot that sort of, in a way, learns from the wisdom and can interact with somebody in their context and provide solutions in their context? Now, that's an opportunity. Now, I haven't acted on it, but I feel I'm sure there'll be somebody who acts on it, and that person will have an edge. So I think whichever journey we are in, I think there's an opportunity for us to use AI to become that much better and to use it as a tool rather than feel it as a threat. But what it will do to the world of careers, it's still, my thinking is still work in progress, Ravi.
The lady in the front is very keen.
The thing is, AI will not take our jobs. If we don't know how to use AI, then we'll lose.
Ah. That's what I meant. Right. Good. Whoa, okay, lots of questions. And then I'll pose you the last question. We'll stay around afterwards.
Yeah. Just two really quick ones, Deepak. The first is, when you spoke about folks getting jobs or opportunities, etc., you said it really doesn't happen through headhunters and stuff like that. It probably happens because of relationships and so on. I've had good friends who've told me that the best way that something like that will happen is through your weakest link and not your close circle. So I just want to comment from you on that. And the second was, and sorry if I can take just an extra minute on this. I was at it's a question on perspectives, really. I was at a program, an experiential program, where the topic for the day was courage. And we were all given small pieces of paper to write the most courageous thing we've done in our lives, write it on that piece of paper and then crush it and throw it on the ground or whatever. And so everyone did it. And in the end, the person who spoke actually set up some large cancer institute because his mother had cancer, etc. Right? Like, and that was his story of courage. After it was over, we were asked to pick randomly some of the stuff that we wrote. And one of them, the thing that he'd written was, he has a shop somewhere in Bangalore and he negotiated the rent down from 10% increase, negotiated down to 5% with the landlord. That is the most courageous thing he has done in his life. Right? Now, that seemed so insignificant compared to this gentleman who'd done this. I just wanted a sense of, when we talk about life and success and potential and all of it, it's also a matter of perspective. Right? So, just comment on that.
You might want to take one last
maybe one last question.
One or two last.
I'm around after this to have discussions.
Yeah, but go ahead.
Can somebody give a mic to him?
I haven't read your book, but I wonder if in your book you've discussed something very basic, a very basic existential issue of what you feel is the purpose of human life.
Okay. Wow. Better order in dinner.
Yes.
Okay.
Hi. So I would like to share that for past 10 years, I have been researching on careers and decision making because I was victim of the system like us. We do something that we don't want to do. And today I'm helping a lot of individuals with it through education. Now I'd like to ask you, as an individual who's helping a lot of people who have gone through a lot of career transitions, what do you think education can do to solve this issue at a level of school and college? Because I obviously am working towards it, but when we see these problems still there, right, at the age of your parents, yours and mine, and now my siblings, and maybe my children, what are we doing about it? And what do you think can be done on an institutional level? Obviously, we are doing it on a personal level, but on an institutional level in India specifically.
So, ma'am, I'm not an expert in education. Clearly, there are many people who are solving the education problem at different levels, right? There is, you know, there is Teach for India, who a lady called Shaheen Mistry runs it. There's Akanksha Foundation. There's a LEED school. There are private organizations. So I think it's a deep-rooted problem, and clearly, education is critical. We need to solve it at scale. But am I the best place to have a point of view on that? The answer is no. So I want to be candid on where I don't have a point of view. I think, to your point, do I have a point of view on purpose? Purpose of life, my experience, again, it's empirical and it's evolving, is that very often I find purpose emerges along the way. I see a lot of people, you know, a lot of people often say, you know, purpose helps clarity. But I find asking somebody what is your purpose is like asking a five-year-old, what do you want to become when you become big? I feel it's too heavy a question for a lot of people to wrap their heads around. What I've observed is, like Ravi said, when we take action in a certain direction, we contribute, we make a difference, purpose often reveals itself, you know? So do I have a clean answer to what is the purpose of life? No, I think many philosophers have written books about it. But I have a little more of a practical take on it to say, let's focus on making a difference in being of value. And purpose, as we walk that path, purpose often reveals itself in the journey. That's my working understanding of the topic. And then we had a question on, I think you spoke about courage, and there was one more, and the networks. Yes.
I think the networks are very practical.
Yes, I think there's a paper written, Stanford paper on power of loose networks by Grano Vetter, if I'm not mistaken. And I think the crux of my understanding is that your first degree of separation will probably have visibility to a very similar world to what you see. But when you go to your third degree network, the probability is their ecosystem is very different. So the A intersection B or A union B will be much wider. So I think the reason they say often when you're trying to, especially when you're trying to reinvent yourself, if you're sort of operating in your first degree, it's like an echo chamber very often. So that's the reason, I think that's sort of the, if I may say, the mathematical reason why, you know, going to the second or third degree, because in a way they come from different worlds and they give you different perspectives and they open up the 9 3/4 platform, as they say in Hogwarts, right? Suddenly, you know, that's when the possibilities open up. Otherwise, you're sort of cooking in the same pond. And I think that limits options.
I don't know if you've got Manish Sabharwal on your podcast.
Not yet.
Okay.
Correct. And your point about courage, yes, I think that's why I feel it's a subjective question. I don't think there's an objective answer to are you playing to your potential and what is courage. I feel my working definition on the topic is we all strive to play to our potential. Are we playing to our potential? Who knows, right? I think it's difficult for us to judge it. I think the best we can do is to strive to play towards it, is my take on it.
Good. No, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to wrap up the evening because otherwise we're going to start losing audience. But Deepak is going to be around and happy to chat further. Deepak, maybe I'll sort of end with something that puzzled me in the book. You know, the word regret. You know, I think for long, quite intentionally tried to live a life so that if my time is up now, I won't have any major regret. And yet in your book, I don't know if I misunderstood it, you said, well, that's not a good idea, that you should actually pay attention to your regrets or whatever. I didn't quite understand it. And so maybe you can end the evening with your reflections on this idea of regret, and including your own.
Sure. I think the insight comes from Dan Pink, who's written a wonderful book called The Power of Regret. And I think it's a bit like the restlessness versus contentment kind of a discussion. I think it's useful at some level to sort of say, to be at peace with the choices we've made and not sort of be restless with, you know, have closure with the choices we made. But what Dan Pink says is that regrets are often a useful signal. You know, I love the phrase he uses. He says they are often like the photographic negative of the life you could have led. You know, and this metaphor, I realize that doesn't land well on people who are born after a certain point in time. but the point is, it has a signal of it's basically what you could have become, and it's that negative which never got developed or which never turned into a positive. And he says that very often that tells you a little bit about what you care about, and it tells you a little bit about your values, because the fact that it's a regret means that it's core to you and you value it. So that signal is useful as you think about choices. So in one of the chapters, when I talk about how we unearth our values, I suggest three approaches. One of them is regret, because I find if we sort of we are a little more intentional about it, it can sometimes carry the signal which can help us in the choices forward. For example, right, when I worked in KPMG in the UK and in India, I wanted to pursue higher studies. Initially, I wanted to do a PhD. But many people said, if you want to come back to a corporate life, do a master's in the West. And I ended up doing a master's. But there was always a desire to do a PhD. Subsequently, you know, that was always a regret I carried. You know, should I have done a PhD? Did I miss out on something? But later, recently, I got an email from somebody who'd been following my podcast. And the person said, there are a lot of podcasts out there, but the reason I like your work is you sort of bring a researcher's mindset to the conversations you have. And it sort of got me going, saying maybe, you know, that sort of that photographic negative that never got developed into a PhD is sort of manifesting in the nature of conversations I'm having. So I think my take on it is let's not be restless with it. Let's not have sleepless nights and be unhappy about our past choices. Let's be content with the choices. But let's also not miss out on the signal that it can carry, which can inform the way forward.
Beautiful. So with that, let's bring the curtain down on the evening. Thank you all for
joining.
Thank
you so much.
And thank you, Deepak, for writing this book. Earlier this evening, he asked me for advice as a fellow writer. And I reminded him that writing a book, even a good book, is 20% of the task, and 80% is going out and singing for your supper like this. So keep at it. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
And Deepak is happy to sign books and be around and chat with all of
you. Yes. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Deepak.